5. The Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session.
Morning. Please be seated. All right, we're here for oral argument this morning in our case number IC25-0030, Core Civic versus Wallace. These proceedings are being video and audio recorded and live streamed, so we ask counsel to please identify yourself and your client at the beginning of your argument. Each side will have 20 minutes. Appellant's counsel is responsible for watching the clock to reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal if desired. Please keep in mind that we've read the briefs and have conferenced the case this morning, and with that, counsel, you may begin.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Bobby Wren. I'm appearing on behalf of Appellants Core Civic and AIU Insurance Company. This matter involves one of the most fundamental aspects of workers' compensation law in Arizona, and that is whether or not an injury arises out of and in the course of an injured worker's employment.
Are you challenging both? Arising out of and in the course of, or just in the course of? I didn't see much of an arising under argument.
We are challenging specifically course of employment in this matter. Course of employment, which, as I'm sure you are aware, is the time, place, and circumstances of an injury and the activities at the time. In this matter, the applicant was driving, and he, in his belief, was driving to Florence Hospital from his place of employment after completing a shift for that day when he was involved in a single car accident. It was his belief that there was an inmate in the Florence Hospital that he was required to perform a check on. The evidence clearly demonstrated that there was no inmate in the hospital on that date, on the date of this accident. The administrative law judge in this matter determined that, made some contradictory findings. The first finding he made was that the applicant was in fact driving to perform an inmate check, to perform a check on an inmate in the hospital. The ALJ then determined that, and I'll quote here, the weight of the evidence establishes that there was not an inmate in Florence Hospital on March 29th, 2024. The ALJ then went on to find that the relevant fact in this matter is that the applicant believed there was an inmate in the hospital and was traveling as a part of his work duties, and then continued, the fact that he was mistaken about an inmate being in the hospital is not sufficient to remove the applicant from the course of his employment. So in short, the ALJ's entire basis for his finding that the matter was compensable was that the applicant believed he was in the course of his employment despite evidence to the contrary. It is our position.
But there was also some evidence to support that, namely the applicant's testimony.
The applicant's testimony was that he had a recollection that there was an inmate in the hospital. His testimony, yes, was that he recalled there was an inmate there. It was his belief, in other words. There was no objective evidence that there was an inmate in the hospital. An applicant himself testified that the evidence that was presented demonstrated that there was no evidence, no inmate in the hospital. So, yes, the applicant's testimony that he recalled there was an inmate there was, as the ALJ specifically found, outweighed by the evidence that there was not an inmate there.
Are you saying that an employee who has a mistaken belief that something he is doing is for his or her job, that that's never enough?
Yes, and that is our position, Your Honor, and that's simply because
even a reasonable mistake?
Yes. I believe so, and that is simply because any applicant who files a workers' compensation claim believes that they are acting in the course and scope of their employment at the time of an injury. Otherwise, they would have no basis to file a workers' compensation claim. The law and jurisprudence from this court and the Supreme Court establishes that there must be more than a simple belief that an applicant is acting within the course and scope of their employment at the time of the injury, which is why the applicant has the burden of proof to establish that they are acting in the course of their employment at the time of injury.
The ALJ's finding was that he was going to the hospital because he believed there was a patient there that he needed to check in on every 72 hours, right?
Yes.
He wasn't going to the hospital to visit a friend or his aunt or do something personal, I think is what that finding means. He was going to the hospital to attend on a prisoner. He was mistaken about whether that prisoner existed at the time or not. But why does that mistake take him outside of what he is doing is in the course of employment?
The course of employment, as I said, it is our position that the course of employment requires more than the simple belief that what an individual is doing is within the course of their employment. There's case law that has essentially determined that belief is not, that a reasonable belief is not sufficient. The Malinsky case was a case where a...
But that case is distinguishable because the employee, sadly, was deceased, and so we had no testimony from the employee as to what the employee was doing. We only had speculative testimony from his wife and others. So I think that's a pretty critical distinguishing characteristic.
Respectfully, I understand that distinguishing characteristic. I still believe it supports the our position in this matter, in that the widow's testimony that she believed that he was traveling to a job to check on a job that he was going to perform that day was insufficient to meet the burden of proof. In other words, the the applicant had to present evidence of what the actual activity was within the scope of the employment. And in that case, the court determined that there was insufficient evidence to meet that burden of proof.
I'm a simple person. I try to put things sometimes into boxes. Is this a coming and going case, a leaving employment or a traveling employee case? None of the above?
It's our position that this is none of the above, that he was not within the course of his employment at the time of the accident. There was some evidence that he may have been traveling home from work at the time of the accident because he was on the same path that he would have taken to go home from work. He had not yet reached the fork in the road where he would take to turn to go to Florence Hospital as opposed to go to his residence.
What about a case like with a delivery driver who has two stops he makes to pick up items every day? On a particular day, he stops at site one, picks up the cargo. It's an hour to stop two. Somewhere between stop one and two, his employer emails him and says, you don't have to go to stop two. There's nothing there for you to pick up today.
Uh-huh.
The employer doesn't check his email or his text message, and he still proceeds along that path, and there's an accident, and he's injured. Are you saying that is not in the course and scope of that employee's employment?
I believe so. If it is the employee's responsibility to be aware of his stops for that day.
So you believe that that employee should not be covered for workers' compensation?
If he had no purpose, if it did not benefit the employer to travel to that second location, correct. Okay. Which is the case here. It did not, the employer received no benefit from the applicant's travel to that hospital that day because there was no inmate there, there were no prison personnel there. He was not instructed by a coworker or superior to travel to the hospital that day. There was, as I said before, there was no objective evidence that there was any purpose for the trip that day other than the applicant's testimony that he had a recollection of an inmate being there that he needed to check on.
What if the second stop is, say, a grocery store? And he stops, he picks up his cargo, he gets out of his truck, and he walks around to the front of the grocery store to buy soda or snack for the ride home, and he gets hit by a car while walking, is that covered?
Again, no, I don't believe it is covered under, I believe it's the pool case. This is the case where an on-call employee was traveling on his way home from a call, I believe, stopped to get a haircut, and then traveled home from that haircut. The applicant alleged that because he was on call and was on the way home from a call, his injury should be found within the course of his employment. The court disagreed, finding that he was not engaged in any activity that was reasonably connected to his employment at the time of the accident. The haircut was a strictly personal errand, and therefore did not arise out of was not in the course of his employment at the time.
What was the ALJ finding in that case? Was it the award against the employee?
I do not recall off the top of my head.
Are you aware of the CSRT case from, I think, like 11 years ago? Maybe more recent than that, where the employee was a delivery driver who went up to Flagstaff, stopped his truck, got in a forklift, and drove the forklift around the front of the store to buy dog biscuits and a soda, and our court said that was still covered.
I understand. I don't recall that case off the top of my head. I believe, though, the basis for finding that was still covered was, and again, I'm not familiar with the facts, but as I would believe it, is that he was on a personal errand while still within the course of his employment. In other words, he was going to continue on with his route after running the errand, driving the forklift, picking up the dog biscuits, and was going to continue on. In this case, there was no initiating event to take applicant to the hospital. There was other than his belief that he had to go there. He was not stopping at one hospital and then mistakenly traveling on to another one. He was not, in the middle of his job duties while traveling.
There was although I thought there was some testimony, maybe you can flesh this out for me a little bit, that when he was reaching down, he had been receiving some communications from a supervisor about an inmate who had self-harmed and had received, I think, a text message. And there was testimony that he had heard an alert on his phone, and that was why he was reaching down to get it. So arguably, wouldn't that support the fact that he's on call 24/7, he's been receiving communications, he knows he has to respond to those communications and possibly go to a facility as a result? Can you kind of flesh out a little bit about the testimony as to why he was reaching down for the phone and whether he did receive a communication from a supervisor?
Certainly. The evidence entered showed that there was no text message at the time of the accident from his supervisor. The evidence showed that the last call he received on that phone was from his son and not from any employee or supervisor at CoreCivic.
But hadn't there been a call right before that? I thought there was something at 7:47 or some kind of communication.
It was, yes, he did receive text messages while he was driving. There was no evidence that...
Do we know who they were from?
Some were from CoreCivic, yes. There was no evidence that the one that he alleges he received at the time of the accident was from CoreCivic. And I believe more importantly is that the ALJ's finding did not rest on him being on call, did not rest on any activity. The ALJ's finding was simply that the relevant fact was that he was traveling. He believed he was traveling to the hospital to check on an inmate. There was no discussion about other basis for being within the course of his employment. The ALJ clearly states, quote, the relevant factor or relevant fact is that the applicant believed that he was traveling for work. To that end, it is...
Which means he was traveling for work, right?
His belief, I do not believe, means he was traveling for work. I don't believe a belief alone is sufficient to simply because you are believe you are something, you're doing something within the course of your employment does not mean you are actually doing something within the course of your employment. To do so would essentially create a presumption of compensability for every workers' compensation claim that is filed. Because by necessity, every applicant that files a claim believes they are within the course of their employment. Otherwise,
no, I think it means we rely on the ALJs to hear the evidence and decide who's more credible and who's not. And we have some role then on appeal. I don't think we should defer or accept every credibility determination that an ALJ makes. And maybe this one falls outside of that general deference that we give. But I think that's the protection for employers, is you have the ALJ who's neutral, who's hearing the evidence and making findings. And here we have a finding that he believed he was going to, he believed he had to go to the hospital because there was a patient there. And I think that means he was going to the hospital for work. I don't see any other reason in the record why he would be going to the hospital.
I agree. I don't believe there's any other reason why he would go into the hospital. It is our position again.
Your position is he was going home.
Our position is that we have no position on where he was going. We believe there's evidence to show that he may have been going home at the time. Our position is simply that his belief is not sufficient to meet the standard to bring him within the course of his employment. There must be some other evidence, some other basis other than his own testimony that I was going to the hospital because I thought I had to for work. I believe, again, any applicant or any person who files a workers' compensation claim will get up and testify, I believe what I was doing was in the course of my employment.
But isn't it up to the ALJ to determine whether or not that's credible?
It's up to the ALJ to determine whether or not that's credible. I believe the law requires more than simply contention that they were within the course and scope of their employment. The law requires specifically that they prove that contention more likely than not.
And that's a pretty low burden.
It's a pretty low burden, but I believe the law establishes that the mere contention is insufficient to meet that burden, as the holding in Malinsky and other cases demonstrate, that it is the applicant's burden to prove their contention that they were in the course and scope of the employment, and not the defendant's burden to disprove it.
So in my hypothetical, with the delivery driver who's between stop one and two, gets an email or text, says, never mind, you don't have to go there, he doesn't check it, he's going to say at the hearing, I thought there was something there that I needed to pick up, because there, like 99% of the time there is. In your view, that testimony would not be enough?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. And I would like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may. Okay. Thank you.
Long time no see.
Yes, Your Honor. It's great to be here, and it's good to see all of you. And to try once again to do my best. I've been rereading Moby Dick. Last time I read it was 1970 in college, I remember, because I did a paper on it. And so many appeals, I feel like Ishmael, who's a crew member on board the Pequod, and he's got a crazy captain who's chasing this whale that chopped off his leg. And when he catches the whale kills him, sinks the ship, kills everybody but Ishmael. But maybe this time I won't be Ishmael on the Pequod.
Does that make us the whale?
In a way, yes, Your Honor. And it was a very, very powerful, intelligent animal, yes. I don't think that was a good recovery. In any event, sometimes the court asks me, is there a rule that you would propose? And I think a good rule would be that when, after considering all of the objective facts and circumstances, including the statements of the applicant, and after gauging the applicant's credibility, if the applicant had a reasonable subjective belief that what the applicant was doing was for the benefit of the employer, and the applicant had a reasonable subjective belief that what the applicant was doing was within the scope and course of employment, then there should be compensation under the workers' compensation system. and requires an evaluation of all the objective facts and circumstances, as well as the subjective belief of the employee.
Does reasonableness in your proposed test inject fault into a no-fault system?
No, I think it's a fact inquiry, really. Is what you're doing reasonable or not reasonable? We know that from the state constitution, the failure to exercise due care is something that is not supposed to be in the workers' compensation system. But if you're trying to figure out what the employer is doing, you have to say, well, do you have a subjective belief? Is it a reasonable subjective belief? I think that's an important factor, and I don't think it violates the principles of workers' compensation to go there.
I think it's the same question.
Yeah, probably is.
Did the ALJ make a reasonableness finding here? And if not, is that the kind of thing that we should be doing or sending back for that kind of finding?
I think implicitly the ALJ made a reasonableness determination here that the subjective belief was a reasonable subjective belief. He said that he thought he was going to the hospital. And part of his job, and a very important job for being the duty officer, is to make sure that the inmates are taken care of. There's a lot of inmates in our system. A lot of them get sick. A lot of them wind up in hospitals. And you've got to take care of them and ensure the safety of the public, including everybody that works at the hospital, the visitors, and everybody else. So it's a very important thing. He had gone to 4 or 5 visits that day. He had hospital visits on the mind. He missed an email that said there was nobody there at Florence. But he had a subjective belief, and he was on the way there, which is an objective factor supporting that he had this belief, just make sure what was going on with the inmate that he thought was at the hospital. And we
asked your colleague here whether this is a coming and going case or a traveling employee case or neither. His answer was that it is neither.
It's a traveling employee case.
And is it your position that that's how the ALJ analyzed it, was as a traveling employee case, and so the findings are consistent with that?
I think so. And there's some case law on this. There's not a lot, but it's I remember the case about the forklift driver, and there were a couple other cases I cited in the brief where people, you know, take these sorts of breaks, and they're still considered within the scope and course of employment.
Is the reasonable belief issue isn't that baked into the credibility finding?
Well, I mean,
if we looked at it and the claimant had not sufficiently established that his subjective belief was reasonable, I suspect that might be one example where we would not defer to the ALJ, even though he or she made a credibility
finding. If you could make that determination based on what's on the record, I don't know where else you can go. But here you've got a pretty strong record. You've got a very conscientious employee who's doing a very difficult job. He's got this on his mind. He thinks he's doing the right thing. And he's on the way to the hospital. He's not going home. He's on the way to the hospital. These are all things that the ALJ is finding in his favor. And one of the most important things, of course, is credibility. I mean, my colleague across the aisle sort of tries to downplay credibility. But it's a key factor here. There's going to be some cases where the worker dies. And you don't really know what was going on in the worker's mind. You can maybe piece together bits and pieces, but we don't have that worry here. We've got a claimant who can communicate, can tell us what he was thinking and doing, and the ALJ gets to weigh all that and come up to a reasonable conclusion, one that's entitled to deference, especially credibility. That's one of those things where they get a great deal of deference.
So if we're inclined to say that traveling employee, the DOT doctrine applies here, can you speak a little bit to the scope of that in this context? I mean, I know you referenced Bergman in your answering brief. Some of those cases talk about overnight traveling employee. I mean, this is more, I would think it would be more like a local. Following those. But, you know, can you kind of help flesh that out, the scope here? It is a unique situation where he's, you know, on call 24/7, expected to respond. There was testimony about someone having to leave a wedding to respond when he was ADO. But that'd be helpful if you could flesh that out a little.
I'd like to flesh it out. Could you give me a slightly shorter question, Your Honor?
I don't know if I'm capable of that, okay. But I will do my best. So a lot of the traveling employee cases, you know, talk about how they're on a business trip. Oh. And so, you know, if something happens, obviously they're going to be, you know, sleeping in a hotel, and it talks about kind of the risk to the employee at that time.
Okay.
But this is a unique situation where is he still working if he's once he's gotten home?
I think I've grasped the threat.
That wasn't shorter, but.
It was helpful. Thank you so much. The cases I cited were about people who were traveling employees, but they weren't overnight kind of traveling employees. This is what the hospital, the hotel worker who goes out, takes people around, stops, picks something up and gets injured, or the salesman who's going around to different places, schmoozing clients, and he crosses the street and gets hit. They are working within the scope and course of their employment because these things they're doing in their travels are part of what they're supposed to be doing and part of what they believe is the right thing to do for their employer. And here we've got a very conscientious employee with a huge amount of responsibility, and he thinks that there is somebody there at the Florence Hospital. He needs to go there. He's on the way there, and then he gets injured in this freak accident, which itself, as you suggested, may actually be part of the scope and course of employment. If he thinks he's getting a text message or if he thinks he's getting a call from work and he leans over to get the phone and he gets injured there, I never thought of that, but in a very narrow sense, that is also scope and course of employment. So let me see if I've got anything here else.
Do you agree with your colleague, though, that the record does not support that he received a text at the time or near the time of the accident from his employer?
No, I think the record is strong that he was, during the course of that trip, he was getting messages from work and messages not from work. But he couldn't tell when the phone goes off. I mean, he was juggling with it and fiddling with it, and he couldn't tell what it was. But, there's so much here. I hate to get existential because I'm incapable of handling that level of abstraction, but you've got something going on here that's very important. And I think this case, in a sense, is unprecedented in its clarity. That there are many times when, as an employee, you think that what you're doing is what you're supposed to be doing. It's in the scope and course of your employment. You're doing the best you can to help out your employer, to make sure that you're doing your work conscientiously and properly. And that should be a major factor in considering whether you are within the scope and course of employment. And don't just throw it aside by saying subjective. The implication from my colleague across the aisle is that everybody who files a workers' compensation claim is saying, well, I was in scope and course of employment. Well, in a sense, and I think there's some people that file those claims and don't really believe that. But here, we're not on the fringe here at all. And this is not an everyday case. This is a case where we have a gentleman who is with immense amount of responsibility. This is the kind of thing he's supposed to be doing, making sure about these hospital patients that are inmates at the institution, making sure they're safe and taken care of, making sure the public's safe and taken care of. And he happens to not remember correctly, but he's on the job, on duty. He's actually on the road heading to the hospital. And at a minimum, when he gets to the hospital and finds there's no inmate there, he will have helped out his employer in that sense. Scratch that box off. There's nobody there to worry about. So it's to me, I submit to the court, that this is within the scope and course of employment.
What if he had made it home and then left?
Oh, then we start getting...
Then we have a coming and going case?
Probably.
Yeah.
And there was another one. I meant there's also the frolic and detour. And I don't think this is a frolic and detour.
So that's what makes this case unique in the traveling employee sense, is that he had not reached home base at the time of the accident.
No, I don't.
He was at work. He went to Florence High. I think it's part of his
job too.
Service.
Right.
Went back, dropped off the work vehicle, picked up the personal vehicle, and still had not made it home yet.
Yeah. Yes. And he wasn't going home. He was going to the hospital. So this was all in his mind and in reality, objective reality. This was within scope and course of employment. Malinsky. Malinsky is one of those cases that you look at and you go, why did they cite it? I mean, the ALJ found that at the time of the accident, the employee was on his way home. And that's not what we have here. That he was not performing services for his employer. Well, he was performing a service for the employer. He was going to get to the hospital and find out what was going on there. And he definitely thought he was performing a service for the employer. And that the accident did not arise out of scope and course of employment. That's just a conclusion. The big thing in Malinsky is that the finding that he was on his way home.
So we'd have a Malinsky case if the claimant's home was in the opposite direction of the hospital, and that's the road he was on.
That'd be a
problem. Even if he said, I was about to turn around, maybe pull a U-turn and head back to the hospital.
That would be a powerful factor for the ALJ to try to deal with. Unfortunately, the ALJ had a good set of facts here and good indication of where he was going and what he was intending to do, especially right out of the horse's mouth. He said right there what he was intending to do, and he was very believable in doing that. My colleague said, across the aisle said, I don't believe, it's not exact words, but it's close, I don't believe there was any other destination than the hospital, and there was no evidence that there was any other destination. It's up to the ALJ to determine credibility, and I've given you my proposed rule. I think I've answered your questions. I love talking with you folks. If there's anything else. No. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
In my brief allotted remaining time, I'd just like to point out a few things that I believe actually work in our favor here that my colleague mentioned. The first is that, as my colleague mentioned, he had already gone to 4 or 5 hospital visits that day. I believe that works against finding that his travel there was reasonable in that he already knew which hospitals had inmates in there. He had already traveled to a number of hospitals. He was aware where he needed to go, and he should have been aware, and it's not reasonable to believe that there was an inmate in the Florence Hospital based on the fact that he had already traveled to a number of hospitals to check on inmates.
Well, he had an email for several hours, right, that said there were not.
Correct. Yeah. I believe my colleague is also mistaken in alleging that there is a benefit to the employer by his travel to Florence Hospital because they would have known that there was no employee there or no inmate there. The employer, CoreCivic, already knew that there was no inmate there. They had sent emails around documenting that there was no inmate in Florence Hospital. There would be no benefit to the employer whatsoever by his visit there.
Can you remind me, I know there was testimony or some sort of, I think it was testimony about how there had been an inmate at Florence Hospital the prior week.
Yeah.
And I think the applicant testified that he was familiar with that person being there.
Yes, there was an inmate there, I think, 3 days prior to this accident, but had been discharged long before, several days before this accident. There had not been an inmate in that hospital, I believe, for a few days.
Was the patient discharged before the claimant was the ADO?
I do not recall.
Okay.
I don't know that off the top of my head. With regards to the proposed rule that a reasonable belief should be sufficient, I don't believe that's at all what's warranted under the law. I think under the Charles case, in fact, that was cited by applicant, the analysis was whether or not the activity itself was reasonable, not the belief of the applicant was reasonable.
Yeah. So your test would be the employee's belief, subjective, objective, is irrelevant.
Correct.
It's whether there was something work-wise to do as a matter of fact, in reality, to the place where they were traveling.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for your helpful argument and your briefing in the case. We'll take the matter under advisement and get you a ruling in due course.